Before we get to this episode, just to say thanks to everyone who's bought my new book, Champion Thinking, How to Find Success Without Losing Yourself. Published by Bloomsbury, the response has been terrific. It's an Amazon bestseller. It's been top 20 in the airport charts consistently, and the reviews have been terrific right across the board. And if you like this episode that you're about to hear on Flow, you'll be sure to enjoy Champion Thinking. Head to my website, simonmundy.com, or Amazon, Waterstone, Smith's, places like that, to get your copy.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
This is Don't Tell Me the Score, the podcast that uses sport to explore life's bigger questions. My name is Simon Mundy, and each week I sit down with an expert from the biggest sporting names in the world to Buddhist monks, neuroscientists, psychologists, and philosophers. We discuss a theme that tells us something insightful and important about life and how best to live it, from the importance of self-acceptance to facing addiction and developing resilience, right through to getting your circadian rhythms in sync and how to sleep better. Sport is a metaphor for life, and in this podcast, I aim to prove that right. I always like hearing from you, so the best way to get in touch is via my website, simonmundy.com, or I'm at Simon Mundy on social media. In this episode, I'm talking to Sir Clive Woodward, who was in charge when England won the Rugby World Cup in 2003, and the theme is culture.
Clive Woodward,
how are you?
Very well, thank you. Good to be here.
Thank you very much for coming on Don't Tell Me the Score. Listen, I've got to tell you, I was out there in 2003. I was in Australia. I couldn't actually quite believe it happened. England winning the Rugby World Cup, to me, that helped all the success in all the other sports in all the years that we've enjoyed since. To what degree do you go along with that statement?
Well, it's very kind of you to say that. I'm not sure I can comment on that outside of... I think the more I look back, the more I realise that was a pretty amazing achievement, especially that night. I mean, even looking at the recent World Cup in Japan, you know, people were saying to me after England played so well against New Zealand, that was the best ever performance and all this, which potentially it was. Then when I saw the team lose in the final, I suddenly started to think back, because everyone said to me, well, yes, you won the World Cup final, but you didn't really play that well. Looking back now, I think we played really well to actually deliver a World Cup final win. When you think the team actually won in Australia against a really good coach in Eddie, a really top team, the Australians had just beaten New Zealand in the semi-final. So the more thing about it, that night was absolutely probably England's best ever performance, because we actually won the tournament. And it's interesting, since that game a couple of weeks ago, you know, so many people have said to me, what happened? And my best conversation was with a taxi driver who said to me, what happened? And I was trying to explain. He said, it's a bit like going to the Olympics, watching Usain Bolt in the semi-final get the world record, and everyone's going, wow, 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 this is amazing. And then 3 days later in the final, he comes fourth. You know, and he it was a great analogy because what he was trying to say is, you know, World Cups are not about performance, getting 10 out of 10 and all this stuff. It's about winning. Uh-huh. And Olympic Games are no different than that. So it's about winning gold medals. And, you know, no one remembers who came second. And, you know, England being to 4 World Cup finals, now we've won one. So looking back at 2003, it was, you know, a huge achievement, which I'm hugely proud of, and everyone involved in the team.
I certainly think, though, for me, I know you're not going to be drawn in it, but for me, it broke that glass ceiling. And I think that a lot of the Olympics, various successes that have come that we've become used to me, can be almost traced back to some degree to that moment, because it suddenly made everyone realise that actually, under the greatest pressure, on the biggest stage, British side, English side, can actually do the business. I mean, it was like the Roger Bannister. To what degree this is a bit of a myth or not, but, you know, that he did the 4-minute mark and then everyone knows it's possible, yeah, and then it happens.
Well, it was great. I think what I really enjoyed was after the World Cup was meeting coaches from other sports. You know, Dave Brailsford was, you know, that sums him up. He wanted to know all about it. He just wanted to meet him, wanted to kind of, you know, totally kind of dissect everything we'd done, how we're going to learn about doing it. And I suddenly started to meet, you know, football coaches, Brailsford, a lot of Olympic coaches. And that's what I really enjoyed. And it wasn't, you know, and it was just sharing views and ideas. And because there is a commonality going through how you actually do this. It's a high-performing team. You know, I have this saying that, you know, great teams made of great individuals. Although you're very proud you're managing a team, I think sometimes you can overdo the team stuff where, you know, I'm very, very clear about this. If you get every individual in your team operating at his or her optimum level, the team stuff becomes a lot easier to do. So in other words, in the rugby team, I'm trying to create players who are the best in the world. And there's no doubt, you know, in that World Cup final team in 2003, you know, we probably had 6 or 7 players who had gold medals around their neck, meaning they would have gotten any team.
Yeah.
Then we had 4 or 5 with silvers and a couple with bronzes. So everyone's on the podium. So you look at your team, if you've got that and everybody is really doing their jobs, 24/7, 365, trying to become the best player they possibly can, the team stuff becomes a lot easier to do.
Mm.
And that's what I think we achieved.
In your new book, How to Win, you talk obviously about, like, leaders and basically empower great people to some degree. And what I found interesting as well is your journey. You were a football man and then were sort of press ganged into playing rugby, press ganged all the way up into the England team. A frustrating experience, wasn't a huge amount of winning, and certainly didn't play the style of rugby that you like to play. 90s England started to get a bit of success, and then when you came in, though, you didn't even have an office. From that moment through to the end, culturally, you had completely transformed the setup, and that's at the base of all the success we all enjoyed.
Yeah, I think I was looking back, I was kind of lucky because, you know, as a player, you know, I played in the amateur days, you know, and they really were amateur. I was lucky enough to play in one Grand Slam team for England in 1980 with an amazing group of players, you know, Billy Beaumont, mm-hmm, and Frank Cotton, Peter Wheeler, Roger Utley. We had a household names, and we won one Grand Slam in 1980. But outside of that, we were the big underachievers. The game was so amateur. You know, I played 21 times for England, which doesn't sound very many today, but that was like 4 or 5 years in those days because we only really had the five nations to play in. And looking back now, we were so amateur, and I would have given my right arm, and still would today, to play professional rugby or professional sport in that one small moment in your time where you can give it everything. And I couldn't do that. You know, I was working for Xerox at the time, who was a photocopy company up in Leicester, and, you know, I'd literally play for England on a Saturday in front of 75,000 people and all that goes with that. And then Monday morning, I'm in the Rank Xerox office, give my forecast in how many flipping photocopies I'm going to sell that week. I mean, looking back now, you couldn't make it up, but that was what amateur was about. And then lucky enough, the game goes professional. I'm running my own small finance company now. And I think what the running your own business is gave me a really, really big leg up into actually coaching the actual team because, you know, when the game went professional, I was the first full-time professional coach. And you're kind of starting from a blank bit of paper. So I was really lucky. It was, you know, I literally didn't have an office or anything in Twickenham. You know, no one knew what was going on. And I could just start from scratch. And I just kind of threw the kitchen sink at it in terms of all my experience, but mainly my business experience about how to develop. And all I knew, and I said to the players from day one, you know, we're ranked 6th in the world, never been above 6th in the world, which is ridiculous considering the players we've got, the money we've got, the expertise we've got in England. I was determined to keep the whole organisation English, you know. I started to really develop the team. I have to say, the RFU, which is often a much maligned organisation, they were fantastic with me, you know. The chief executive came in, a guy called Francis Brown. He totally backed what I did. You know, it wasn't easy. You got to sit down with these guys and explain it to them, but they backed me, what I was trying to do. And, you know, it wasn't a straight line. We had you know, big losses. We lost in the quarterfinals of the first World Cup. I'd only been there less than 2 years. You know, we got beat by South Africa. But they were fantastic. They totally backed me. And it was really, really strange that looking back now, because they backed me totally. You win the World Cup, and then you think it's all going to go fantastic. We're going to take a real dynasty. We'll never, ever get beaten by the All Blacks again. And then we all fall out after the World Cup. And it was one that was a strange period of time.
Yeah, really, it's only just sort of got back together in many ways, you know, since that time.
Yeah, that's why I think Eddie's done a good job, because, you know, I don't want to call out anyone's names, but I think we have made some mistakes on, you know, who was coaching the team, what we've done. There's been a big, big gap since 2003, basically. I think Jones came in 4 years ago, and we, you know, we just got bombed out of our own tournament, didn't make the quarterfinals even, which was huge disappointment. Again, you just can't believe we've got a World Cup at Twickenham, and we don't get out the pool, which was just not acceptable. So I think Jones has come in, and it's a good place for him to come in. It's a bit like me. You come in, you're absolute rock bottom. It can only go one way, and he's a top coach. And he's done a great job. You know, 4 years later, we've made the World Cup final, but you know, the whole team will be devastated by what happened in the final, but he got them to the World Cup final, which is an amazing achievement.
And they're a young side, you know, 4 years on. Anyway, listen, let's turn our attention, though, to what you have distilled down here. So you mentioned Xerox, and even though you wish you could have played professional rugby, had you not had all your experiences at Xerox, you clearly brought some of your external experience to bear in the England role. Could you have done that without your external experience? And the reason I ask that is I've done a podcast on diversity and diversity of experience and how valuable it can be bringing knowledge in from a different sphere. And it seems like that's what you did.
Oh, I'm massive on diversity. I actually run a company now called Hive Learning, which is all about diversity and inclusion and understanding the importance of it in all these ways, in terms of the culture of the business, but just thoughts and ideas. And I think I had two business careers. One was Xerox, big multinational. But probably most importantly, or probably more importantly, was then, you know, in the early 90s, I set up my own small leasing and finance company based on the skills I learned with Xerox and Xerox Finance. So I set a small business up. I was running that small company, and we grew it from 2 people to like 10. So it was generally small, but it was just like 10 people in a room. There was 10 of us. It was great, great fun. And I learned so much. I was obviously the boss. I was the chief executive. But you just learn how to handle people, how to take risks, how to, you know, get things done. So when you take over the England rugby team, it's no different. You're running a small business. And this is what I say to people. Running a rugby team is no different than running a business. Right. It's achieving results through people. And that's why I come back to my favourite line. You know, great teams are made of great individuals. It's all about the people. And I was dead lucky. We had an amazing group of players. You know, Martin Johnson, Delalio, Wilkinson. You know all these guys. But they'd never achieved anything. And now I had to set the vision that this was only had one goal in mind. And it wasn't actually to win the World Cup. It was to become the number one ranked team in the world. To do that, that shows excellence over a sustained period of time, which we kind of delivered on. But I think what I learned from running my own small business gave me the kind of real confidence of handling people. Also, things like just managing upwards, being able to talk to the chief executive, the board at the RFU, get things done, take these people with you. And I said, you know, the RFU were fantastic with me. They really did back what I was doing. And I like to think we delivered in spades, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. So the lessons, you know, that you talk about are very much obviously applicable to sporting teams. They're taken from your time with England, but also to businesses. And to some degree, you can almost apply them individually. And you talk about, you know, a winning culture being about well-judged risk.
Yeah. I think well-judged risk, this is predicated by what I call learning. Again, I have this saying about relentless learning. If you're an individual, if I'm going to work with you, I want to try and make you the best broadcaster in the world. That's our goal. But this has got to be a two-way thing. So if I'm working with a rugby player or anybody, you know, I want to make you better at what you actually do. But we need a two-way thing. And to be a two-way thing, you've got to engage in the process. I want you to become a great learner. I want you to be out there studying what's going on. You coming back to me with ideas. So it's not just a one-way thing where I'm coaching you and it's all from this side of the desk. I think to create champion individuals, it's about a two-way process. And we're going to get on fine if I feel you're putting in the effort, you're learning, you're coming up with thoughts and ideas. We are going to fall out if I think this is one way and you're sitting there going, well, you're the coach, I'm the player, I'll do what I'm told. That's not what champions do. And my experience in Olympic sports was fantastic because, you know, I had this incredible experience with England, met absolute superstar rugby players. But then when you go in the Olympic world, you see the DNA is no different. When you're lucky enough to meet, you know, Wiggins and Hoy, you know, Rebecca Adlington, Pendleton, these amazing athletes, they're no different. They're the same DNA. They're all complete sponges. They're all not yes people. They really own their own program. They work really well with the coaches. And this is where my exposure to Olympic sport, which reinforced everything I learned in the in the rugby team about how you create champion teams. And you've got to get absolute engagement from every individual. And if that individual doesn't want to engage, you're not going to be anywhere near as successful as you possibly can be.
Now, you mentioned sponges there. Some people might not know what we're talking about, but you do have, to some degree, your own sort of vocabulary. And before we get to sponges, because that's down the track, one I do want to talk about is teachability, because that relates to what you're talking about here. And you talk about it being, if you were to work with me, you'd want me to have that buy-in. And the key element is an ability to take on knowledge pumped by intrinsic passion. So you've got to have that passion for the subject, which makes it that much easier to take on information and to search it out.
Yeah, teachability, it's a bit of a mouthful, but it is, you know, my definition of AICM, it's your ability to learn, it's your ability to take on knowledge, and quite simply, in its purest sense, your passion for what you actually do. You know, I remember, you know, meeting athletes who, you know, if you sat them in here now and you talked about what was going on in the Olympics, what was going on in the election, what was going on with Boris and Corbyn, you'd struggle. If you ask them to talk about their sport, you won't struggle. You know, some of these people got little or no education. But you ask them to talk about their sport, go away and study it, they'll come back with them bucket loads and bucket loads and bucket loads. So this teachability, it's not about having been to the right schools or some wonderful education. It's a passion for what you actually do.
You gave the example of two boxers at the Olympics. I thought this was really nice.
Yeah, there's a couple of boxers who were, you know, from travelling families almost, little or no education. You know, as I said, if you sat them down here and talked about some of the stuff I spoke about, you may struggle. Talk about boxing, and I did. They come back in bucket loads, and their eyes just open. Their passion is boxing. Their knowledge, their understanding. They can talk to me all day about this, and I, you know, I'm just learning from them. Mm. Because they've got this passion. And what I'm saying, if you want to be a real champion, a gold medal winner, win World Cups, you've got to have a passion. That's an underlining thing. But that's what I call teachability. Mm. And the opposite of teachability is somebody who's uncoachable, unteachable, a bit of a know-it-all, doesn't want to engage. And they could be the most talented person in the world. But in my experience, they're not going to make it. And, you know, you've got all sorts of examples of extremely talented people who've not made it because I think they've become unteachable, uncoachable. They do think they know it all. And you never, the moment you think you know it all, you're going to come second.
Well, Socrates, yeah. Wasn't it who said, the only thing I know is how little I know? Humility exactly. Is absolutely key, and this is a key factor. And you had that in the way you approached being an England coach, didn't you? You were always looking for little bits that you could take from various areas to improve. You gave a nice bit about you'd have people come and stay at Pennyhill Park and they had to give you one thought or whatever. And even though perhaps immediately your ego might bristle, actually, that's where you got some great ideas from. So humility's key.
I used to love bringing into the England team, and the players didn't even notice these guys or ladies, just people who are kind of friends of mine. But I knew they're fans of rugby, but I knew they're successful in whatever they were doing, from hedge fund managers to captains of industries to headmasters and headmistresses of schools. And I used to just bring them in and just say, look, I want to show you everything. You sit in the back of the room, keep out the way. You don't go gaga when Johnny Wilkinson walks in. Just keep out the way and keep a low profile.
I didn't hear, honestly.
But we're gonna show you everything, yeah. You know, because I trusted them completely. But I'm showing you everything because I want you to think, you know, is there anything else we should be doing? Used to drive me nuts when some flipping hedge fund manager who hadn't played rugby since he was prep school under eights would come up with an idea we'd not thought about, and we're supposed to be this high-performing team. And I always sort of laugh, and then you sit down with your team and go, listen, I've had this great idea. And that's how it kind of works, you know. So you bring them in, it'd be amazing where new ideas can come from.
Yeah.
And, you know, I love, you know, when I'm sometimes asked to speak at, say, corporate events, you know, I love sitting in the back of the room listening to other people speak. Because, I love sitting, you can sit in the back of the room and I've listened to amazing speakers. You just sit in the back of the room with a bit of paper and a cup of coffee and you're always thinking about things. Mm. And just a phrase or a saying, and that's where I picked this all up from. And I always pride myself on now not being good at new ideas. What I pride myself on is listening and going, wow, that's a good idea. Then what I think I'm quite good at is if it's a good idea, put it in place and make it happen, and getting it done. I think that's what a good leader will always do.
So that's discover, to still do, which we'll do. Now, you talk about great people having that desire to learn, Barack Obama and Clinton, whatever, who will factor in an hour a day of learning. Personally, I found it interesting. I'm more keen to learn now than when I was a younger man. But a lot of people, I think, perhaps do stop looking to learn. I'm assuming then you are very much in that Obama camp.
Yeah, a bit like you. I think when I was at school, I wasn't a great learner. I wasn't a great academic. I wasn't sort of anyone who stood out academically. I think it's more when you've got into this role, especially in the, well, not this role, only in the business world where I was sort of, you know, I joined Xerox, especially I was kind of a graduate trainee and you were really encouraged to study and I wanted to be successful. So I started to really study on my own. Mm. And I say to players now, you know, with technology now and the internet, there is no excuse. There's so much out there all the time. So yeah, I absolutely pride myself on learning, and you know, I would, you know, without any exaggeration, I'd get on a plane tomorrow and go anywhere in the world if I thought I had a chance of making me a better coach or a better manager or a better person in terms of what I actually do. I think once you lose that passion, your teachability, then you're going to come second. Mm. The moment you lose that, it's time to step back from whatever you're actually doing. But once you've still got that drive and passion, this is why I think people can go across different businesses, different sports. If you've got passion for it and you love it, you'll be fine. If you haven't got that absolutely drive, then I think that's where people come up short, and they seem to be surprised by it. But they, and you can spot them. You can just see guys who are really putting it in. And you mentioned, you know, Johnny Wilkinson, Jason Roberts, and all these guys, you know, as hugely talented players. You see them on the pitch, on the field, and they're amazing. I've been lucky enough to see them off the pitch and just what they actually put in, you know, and they're the guys coming up with ideas. Have you thought about this? Have you thought about that? I've heard about this. Or I've read about this. And then if you get the whole team inputting, suddenly you've got all these ideas, and your job as the kind of the head coach or the boss is to kind of filter them and disseminate them down to make sure you don't do them all because you just don't have time. Yeah. But if you think one, you know, this idea is going to make the boat go faster, I'll do heaven and earth to make sure we put it in place. I won't be looking back in the months or years time going, oh, if only we'd done that. So sometimes they work, most times they do. It's not a case of being reckless about it. You've got to really study them, understand it, can we afford it, can we do it, and then just drive it forward. And knowing you've got a team of people who are going to say, okay, we'll give this a go. If it works, great. If it doesn't, we won't worry about that. Yeah, yeah. At least we've tried it. That's where Johnson was great. People don't understand Martin Johnson at the time. Johnson was one of the best players I've ever coached. He's a rugby, people forget how good a player he was. But as captain, he was great. I was just saying, look, we're going to do this. And he'd just go, fine, let's get on with it. Don't need to talk about it. We'll soon let you know if it's going to work or not.
Yeah, then
we get on with it. And that was his big strength, because that's what he wanted. You didn't want some guy or your captain debating it and have a big issue about it. Let's get on with it and we'll soon find out.
To me, that's part of what life's all about, is continually growing. And you can apply it, obviously, to business, to sport. You can apply it to, you know, yourself, to relationships, to any sphere. Do you agree that growth and never-ending learning, if you like, is part of what it's all about?
I think that's what everything's about. I call it relentless learning. That's my saying. You've got to be, because I think I use the word I think relentless applies to sport. You've got to be relentless about it. But there's a real process. You know, I like the idea of spending an hour a day on learning or improving yourself. It could be physically or mentally, but 1 hour just on yourself. And I think that's not too much to actually ask.
Yeah.
But it's not all just the physical side. You know, I like the teams of people I'm working with. I like everyone to kind of look the part, be the part, get physically fit as well as mentally fit. But I can come back to learning and working in a room of people where you know ideas are going to come through, and you learn from each other, not only from yourself. You can really bring ideas to the table for other people to actually think about as well.
So let's talk about sponges and rocks. So sponges basically are just people, you know, like Martin Johnson, who say, let's give it a whirl. And rocks are the people who are lacking humility and stuck in their ways. And something that comes up repeatedly on Don't Tell Me the Score is having a growth mindset that I'm not good at something ... yet. Yeah.
A sponge and rock, I mean, what it is having a sponge between your ears or a rock between your ears. And I think keeping the stress is you're never one thing or another. And normally when you join new sports teams, new companies, new jobs, you're a sponge. You like, you know, learning, you know, listening to programs like this, just in case you were to learn something, you are a sponge. Often it's the longer you've been in an organization, you can just drift into being a rock where you suddenly think, I'm not going to do this anymore. And I think if you become the rock as the leader of the team, you are going to come second. But if you see someone in your team who's drifting, that's when you just got to sit them down and go, look, we've got to get you back. And we need you really inputting, thinking about this, how you used to be. And most people don't actually know they've just drifted into being a rock. It's not something you consciously do. And that's the secret to management. Can you get everyone everybody in your organization, your team, really thinking, really inputting all the time? So it is a very conscious thing. And, you know, I think the words kind of work. You're a sponge, you're a rock, and it becomes part of the language. You see, the players ring me up, and you get a player ringing you up. Look, I'm not being a rock, but
really, it's dripped into them like that.
Yeah, it's in the language. I'm a sponge, you're a rock, and I need everyone. I'm looking around the room. I need everyone to be sponges, and it's just simple language, but I think people can understand it.
Yeah.
You know, sponge between your ears, not a rock between your ears.
Absolutely.
And as I say, sometimes it's the more senior people that've been there for a long time where they do think they know it all. And they don't. The moment you think you know it all, then I think you're in a dangerous position.
So to have those conversations, to bring a rock back into the world of sponges, and you talk about this, the importance of communication. So what are some of your communication rules then?
Well, I probably, and I can say this pretty confidently because I've been involved with the Olympics and all their sports, I'd probably have more one-on-one meetings than any coach I've ever seen. And sometimes it's hard because it takes more time. You know, you see a lot of people have team meetings. To me, you know, the one-on-one meetings are absolutely key because you can, you know, eyeball someone and really get across what you're trying to say, especially if you're not happy with them, if it's a negative. You can't hide from this.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
And certainly if you just go back to your kind of my business career, certainly in a big multinational in say Xerox, people get away with being a rock. You know, you can just dream to be, no one's going to bring you back because, okay, he's been here a long time and all that stuff. When you run your own small company, you can't have a rock. And also that perhaps that someone just stands out. Because if you have one rock in your team, you know, and it's a small business, you're going to go out of business. You know, the kids are going to have to change schools, you've got to sell your house. This is big stuff. So running a small company, you can't hide. And you certainly can't be in a rock because your whole company is going to actually suffer for it. And that's one of the things I really, really learned. And that's why I really admire people running small businesses because you know how tough it is. But it's far more exciting because you're involved with this, you know, every day we're trying to take on the big boys and all this sort of stuff. And the same happened in sport and the rugby team. You know, I was very, very clear. You know, I look back on my England career with huge kind of regrets. You're hugely proud to play for England. But looking back, we never really took on the big boys. We never said, we can be better than the All Blacks. When I took over the team, you know, I had to sort of put up or shut up now because I've been saying all this stuff. So you get the big job. And I said, right. And I was very clear, the only enemy, and it was the only enemy, was the All Blacks, South Africa and Australia. That was it. I kind of like the Six Nations. I love France. These are our kind of friends. Yes, we compete. But the real enemy was the Hemisphere. And we had to now absolutely take them on. And those games became the big games of the year. The Six Nations was great fun. The big games, can we start to beat Australia? Because we had to get the mindset over them. But we had to do it on the field of play, but off the field of play. We had to become better at them, everything we actually did, which I've got no doubt we did. By 2003, I think those three teams especially were looking at England. We're the number one ranked team in the world, but they were going, what the hell are they doing now? And Eddie said really complimentary things about us. You know, he said, you know, we're all chasing England now.
Yeah.
But then, unfortunately, after the World Cup, it all...
But that sort of comes back to what I was sort of saying at the beginning in terms of get that inferiority complex. And I loved what you did in terms of stopping calling them the All Blacks and referring to them as New Zealand. You know, some
I'll
of that.
Stick for that, by the way.
But that was a masterstroke, you know. Right, so communication we spoke about. Another thing that came up that I really enjoyed was you talking about mindset. And again, this comes back to rather than, you know, you being the guy who tells everyone how things should be, it's about getting people to have buy-in to be part of the process.
Again, I guess this is from my just business training. I love these little, but one of my favorite things is no such thing as a dumb idea. It doesn't matter if you're the newest person in the team. If you've got a thought or idea of something we can do that's better, you've got to stand up and say it, whether it's privately to me, one-on-one, or in front of the team. There's no such thing as a dumb idea. Where you and me are going to really fall out, if you're sitting there with a thought and you're kind of a bit nervous about saying so because you're worried about what I may think as the head of the team, or you're going to get some banter and stick from your teammates, then we are going to fall out. So you've got to get that culture where people are very confident about what they're putting in. And also, especially the England team, think of the England team, it's not a full-time business. These players all come from 12 different clubs. They've all got great coaches. They've all got different ways of doing things. So you've got to find a way where very quickly we can create the England way of actually doing things that kind of takes into account everything you've done in your own clubs. They're all very different. Mm. Even just simple stuff. You know, the way Leicester will defend will be different than the way Wasps defend. So suddenly you've got players coming in with different ways of doing things. So your job, my job as a head coach, was to get all these ideas coming in and then absolutely make decisions. This is what we're going to actually do. You know, you can't delegate the whole thing. But what you do want is real open debate, real open discussions. You know, our team meetings got a bit tasty at times. They were great fun because we wanted to win. And that's what I really loved. I love when things got a little bit spiky, you know, the testosterone was flying around the room. But as long as we all walked out the room holding hands and smiling, that was what it's all about. But I think in the team meeting rooms, because we want to win, and when we start to, you know, evaluate some of the performance and some of the stuff, it really got quite interesting at times because we wanted to win. We knew we had a team that could win the World Cup, and this was a chance of a lifetime, but we weren't going to win it if we're all going to sit there and actually be sort of a little bit quiet or conservative in putting our views forward. And, you know, it was my job then, a new guy comes in the team, because we could have an 18-year-old, and I'm saying, this guy could be right. You know, I'm not assuming he often was. He comes with a fresh thought, fresh ideas. So it was my job to encourage this person to speak to me one-on-one, or more importantly, what I used to love, speaking in the actual team meeting, have the confidence of an 18-year-old to stand there and say something, knowing that Johnson, Dallaglio, and these guys were all looking at him, and, you know, not being worried about the consequences. And that says a lot about the mindset of any individual. And also, you spot people. You don't want people just speaking for speaking's sake. You're trying to evaluate what they're actually saying, and does it make any sense at all? And I think that's how you grow the business. And you've spoken a few times about growth mindset. It's growth mindset individually and collectively within the whole team.
And you need psychological safety to be able to come into the meetings and know that any idea you come up with is not going to be shot down.
Sure, totally.
You talk about having a young guy come in who might have those ideas. What I find interesting then, to go back to your England career, because you wanted to play an expansive running style of rugby, that at that time there was this pervasive idea that it's not the done thing.
Yeah, playing for England helped me hugely because, you know, I'd kind of been there, got the T-shirt, but hugely frustrating the way we played, because I look back at my England career. You know, first of all, I'm not showing my kids the videos of me playing rugby because they'd all walk out and make a cup of tea because I hardly ever touched the ball. Yeah. I spent most of the time looking up in the air trying to catch the ball. We just kicked the ball all day. And I had this feeling or this kind of vision of, you know, Twickenham, 85,000 people on their feet going nuts by the way we're playing, which I'd never seen before. Twickenham was this quite sanguine, kind of almost dull place where people just watched the game, had a few beers. Mm-hmm. There was no excitement because there was no excitement on the pitch to where we were playing. So my opening third to the players, and I was doing this not to be kind of romantic or anything, was to actually say, if we get 85,000 people on the feet going nuts by the way we're playing, we'll be doing everything right and we're going to take some beating. So we're now going to really look at how we do about that. And this was all about not kicking the ball away, about playing the game so fast from 1 to 15. We're going to play the game faster than anybody else. This was faster than scrums, faster than lineouts. We're going to have to be the fittest team in the world, which when we started, we were nowhere near it. And we're going to play a game that no one can actually live with. And even now, looking back to that 2003, I still think we're ahead of the current team in terms of just the speed we played the game at. You look at the physical conditioning the players were in 2003, it was amazing. And I think we did take the game to a whole new level based on the way we played. And just look at the number of tries we scored. Mm. And the players loved it. There was genuine excitement. And when I'm picking my team also, I'm also thinking, Saturday morning, I want to wake up, see that team should go, wow. Whatever happens today, this team is going to play. But more importantly, the opposition have to play really well to beat this team. And that's how I picked my team. Took certain risks on players. So I wanted to play the game fast. And no one ever done that before, ever, in an England shirt. And, you know, we generally got 85,000 people on the feet going nuts by the way we played.
Absolutely.
And our wing loss ratio between World Cups was astonishing. We played 51 games and won 46. Including 14 away from home. So we played the Southern Hemisphere, the teams we had to beat. We beat them 14 times in a row. That was unheard of.
Yeah.
But it wasn't just because we had these amazing players, which we did, but they really bought into this. We're going to do something special and we're going to love the way we actually play the game now, which I didn't really do as an England player. I love playing for England. Don't make no bones about it. It was great playing for England. Say you play for England. But equally, I'd love to have looked at games and I go, wow, just watch this game. It was fantastic. And I can look back at so many of those games between the two World Cups, just winning it, where you look back from a player, a coach, or a fan, you're, wow, that's a great game to watch.
So let's say that someone would come to you with an idea and from the club. Is this where your performance behaviours would come in, your discover, distill, do? So you would take an idea from one of them. So that's the discovery part, distill it down into a single line and then put it into practice.
Yeah, I call this 3D learning, and I haven't a clue where I picked this up from, but I've had this forever. I can never. It's where I look at any situation. So 3D learning is, if you, let's just talk about scrum defence. So you have scrum defence, so you've got a scrum, we're going to defend a scrum. So the discover is, we're going to get all this information in from all 12 clubs, all the players. We're going to just put all this information, and you never stop discovering. You're learning about what this actually means, what it entails. So you're not just learning from the players, you're learning everything. But the most important thing then is, once you've got all this discover, how do you distill it, the second D, in the 3D learning, how do you distill it down to key points? Like, all this stuff we've learned,
yeah.
What are the key points?
So to be able to put it into like a sentence, essentially.
Simple, maybe three or four just bullet points. Bang, bang, bang.
It's easy to understand.
Totally, it's got to be in simple English. Everyone understands, whoever you are. If I explain it to you, anybody, you'd go, understand. And that's real art. That's your job as your head coach. But you never stop discovering, never stop learning. And you can change these key points, your distilled points, as you go along. But maybe three or four. Then the third D is do. Okay, once we know our key points, which could be, say, defensive scrum, line speed, how do we do it better than anybody else? How do we practice it? How do we train for it? How do we become a real part of what we actually do? So the do is really important. Mm. And also to start to be quite creative. How do we do this? How does a player do this on his own in his back garden with his kids? How can you still be practicing stuff when you're away from the training paddock? And that is really important. So that's the 3D learning. And it's just so simple, but it kind of works. But again, you need the players to understand it. So they're inputting, here's the key points, how do we do it? And even on the do, you know, if anyone can think of a practice, how we do this better, just make sure you bring it in. Of course, we're getting stuff from all over the place then. And that's it. And that was the 3D learning. So you can use it to any subject you can think about,
right?
Anything.
Can you think of just a quick example of like one that would go all the way through?
I can give you hundreds. Let's use the
really drop, simple one, yeah.
The drop goal routine. One wins
zigzag.
The World Cup. Zigzag. You know, so you talk about drop goals. I think drop goals are huge. We start to examine drop goals.
And you'd learned from 99, of course.
We learned
in a brutal fashion.
Five drop goals. When I watched that again, what I can't believe about those drop goals is they're miles out.
He was slotting them from everywhere.
From everywhere. They weren't like in front of the post, like halfway line.
I've never seen a drop. There's never been a drop goal performance.
And he never
like
missed.
Gianni De Beer.
And he didn't. They're all like, they weren't just in front of the post.
Yeah.
So we started examining drop goals, for example. And drop goals to me, not just to win the World Cup in the last minute, but it could be the first minute. You know, we decide when we're going to drop goals because you can't defend it.
No.
I remember this great conversation with, I think it was Johnny and Mike Catt. And this was a serious conversation. I said, okay, just forget the rules of rugby. We get no points for scoring tries. We only score by scoring drop goals. How many we get in a game? Of course, they looked at me. I could see they were going, oh, here he goes. Where's he going on this? So Johnny, I said, come on, Johnny, how many do we get? We've got you in the team. We've got Catt in the team. We both drop goals. How many do we get? I think Johnny said like 10. And then Catt goes, no, it'll probably be 12. I said, okay, let's say it's 10. That's 30 points. How many people are going to score 30 points against this England team? Nobody. So why don't we do it? Just silence in the room. Total silence. You don't see where I'm going.
Yeah, yeah,
so
yeah.
I said, this is important stuff. And so then we start to discover, really think of what it's about. But then most important, what are the key points about drop goals? You know, and then we came up with this distill. Here are the key points. And the zigzag is just how you know, normally from a
best
drop goal.
Best way of doing it.
The best way of doing it. A drop goal, you're probably coming from a scrum or a line out. The World Cup drop goal that won the World Cup was came from a line out. And then we just go zigzag, which is going left, right, left, right. You don't go wide. And the whole mindset of the team is, can we get the ball right under the post so you can't miss? So you can't miss. We're right. And you just punch, punch, punch. Because also what happens, the defence knows the drop goal's coming. So they start to go a bit wider. They're going to try and get the charge down. And that's what happens. Dawson goes through, and we thought about that, and we practiced that, and we drilled this and drilled this and drilled this. And it's interesting, if you can see me on the touchline in that flipping drop goal, because we've gone, I think we're still not close enough. We can go further. We get makes easy yards. And then I can see Dawson lining up Wilkinson. Wilkinson's gone back in the pocket. I'm on the touchline. I'm shouting no, because I think we should go further so we can't miss. This is it.
Yeah, yeah.
There's like 1 minute to go. So Wilkinson, you know, swings his right foot, goes same between the posts. See, then me shouting, yes, yes, yes. At the time, I thought we were too far out.
Right.
I was wanting to go another couple of things. So, but it wasn't just one of those things. I think people's sport just happens. That was a whole process based on how we broke the game down. And the 3D learning of discovered still do was how I, as a coach, implemented it through the players, from a coaching team, and how we practiced it.
Two things to say. First of all, it shows as well that what might seem like a bad experience at the time, the 1999 quarterfinal, may end up being a bit of a blessing in disguise.
That was a bad experience.
Yeah, you said you were in mourning for a few days. Anyway, well, we won't dwell on that.
A few years.
Right. I spoke to Johnny Wilkinson on here. It's well worth having a listen to Johnny talk through his drop goal, because it was like an out-of-body experience. But that's a clear illustration then of your discover to still do. Right, moving on. Let's talk about wasps. Now, you're a wasp, Clive, aren't you? someone willing to challenge things. You've got to have that person who is in a team or in a setup, in a business, who comes in and says, why are we doing this? And you talk about, Yehuda Shinar?
Yehuda Shinar, yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about what he brought to the table?
Yehuda Shinar was introduced to me by a very good friend of mine called Michael Spiro, who was the boss of a company called Ellinex. And in my finance day, we used to do all their financing. And he just, when I was now coaching England, he just said, I've just met this guy called Yehuda Shinar in Tel Aviv, and he's ex-Israeli Air Force or Armed Forces. But he's come up with this program called Winning Behaviors, and he said, I think it's fascinating. So it's me being a sponge, never, it's great, put him in touch with me. Next thing, I'm on a plane to Tel Aviv. Now, I'm coaching England at the time. I literally couldn't wait to go and see this guy because he just sounded fascinating. Yeah. So never been to Tel Aviv in my life before. Just me explaining, me getting onto the LL plane would be an experience in itself. But I eventually got on this plane. I'm in Tel Aviv. And he was amazing. And he literally met me at the airport and went back to his house. And he started calling this thing called SETUP, which is correctly thinking under pressure.
Hey.
And that's where it came from. And but his first thing he said to me, and it was a fascinating thing, I've been coaching him for about a year, I think, or 2 years. He just said to me, okay. And this is why I loved him. He said, I know nothing about rugby. Yeah. There's not a lot of rugby played in Tel Aviv, if we're brutally honest. He said, I've never heard of rugby. I'm a kind of a military person. Mm. I understand football. What are the basics of rugby? So I kind of looked at him, and my immediate question was, well, what do you mean? He said, that's not a good start to our conversation. What are the basics of rugby? And I started thinking about it, and I couldn't answer him. You know, I said, what do you mean by basics? He said, what are the things you've absolutely got to get right? And I started to think about it. You know, was it tackling? Was it passing? Was it all this stuff? I couldn't answer it. And he just said, and he said, well, that sums, we got a lot of work to do. So if you don't know the basics, you don't know the things you've got to get absolutely right, the chances are your team don't, your players don't, and you're all over the place. So I'm like looking at him. It's really annoying me, this guy, at this stage, because I couldn't answer the questions. And I went back, couldn't wait to get my, I spent 2 days in, literally in his house, locked in this room, learning all this stuff. And I went back to my England coaches, and I sat down with the coaches, Andy Robinson, Phil Larder, Dave Redding, Dave, all these amazing guys. And I said, okay, what are the basics of rugby? And of course they couldn't answer me, and they all got different answers. So we started to really study this thing called basics. In other words, what are the things you've absolutely got to get right? And we studied them, and they became so obvious. And the basics of rugby became so obvious, quite simply, scrums, lineouts, and restarts. And even that, scrums was 40%, lineouts was 40%, and restarts was 20%. So we basically learned by all the stats and data that if we picked our kind of reasonably best team within two or three players, if we put the ball in at the scrum and 100% of the ball, and if we put the ball in the lineouts and won 85% of the ball, we never lost a game. So suddenly the basics became that. And then suddenly we start to introduce the players, and we start to realize this was the most important thing. That of all this stuff, you have all this wonderful, amazing stuff. Unless you get your scrum right, your line out right, and your restarts right, especially your scrums right, you can't win the game. So that suddenly started to affect the way we coached, the way we played, the way I selected the team, and the whole thing. And just think that last World Cup final, you know, 14 scrums, and I think we conceded 6 penalties. You can't win the game. You can't win the game. That's it. So suddenly the basics become absolutely key. So I'd say to you as a broadcaster, what are the basics? What are the absolute, okay, say the two things without any shame? If I get this right,
yeah.
If I get this right, I know I'm going to do a good interview or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And you go to companies or sports teams.
You've got to let me answer it, Clive.
I'm going to ask you how to pick. but you go to companies and sports teams and you ask them that and you get the same thing. Then no one can actually say, that is the absolute thing we've got to get right. So what are the basics?
So here they are. And actually, it comes back to another one of your sayings, which is confidence is preparation. And for me, it is two things. Preparation,
yep.
As you've seen, I've done a lot of research for amazing. You. And then the other thing is just planning structure. Those two things, and then they're obviously,
so you know,
obviously
if you,
hit record, but you know.
If you know you get those right, there's a really high chance you're going to, which is fantastic, but you find a lot of people don't. There's interesting, I went to a company, a friend of mine works there. It was a big amusement, not arcade, but you know, where these roller coasters,
yeah,
all this.
Yeah.
It's a big business.
Theme park, yeah.
Theme park, sorry. It was a big, big business. And I sat down with their senior management and said, okay, what are the basics? And for the first company ever, they all as one immediately, safety. They just safety, 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 safety. Unless we all understand the importance, if we have one bad incident here, this place gets shut down. And they understood that. So the basics of their business wasn't creating these wonderful rides and all that sort of stuff. The thing they had to get right, and they're probably the only business where I've had literally say 10 out of 10 people go, write it down, that was the number one thing. They all got that. That's a great start, because you can build on that now. So how do we do safety better? What are our key points? How do we practice it? How do we do it? How do we don't just park it over there and say, we think we've done this. You must always keep on top of it. So in rugby, scrums are lineouts. You the top level, unless you can do all you like, unless you can scrum properly and win your lineup properly, you can't win the game.
No.
And that's what...
And we saw it in the Rugby World Cup final, didn't we? England's scrum.
That was it. People say to me, what happened? That's what happened. Yeah. You can talk all day about all the other stuff. Their scrum got smashed, and you can't... I coached England over 80 times. I can't recall our scrum ever going backwards, because I learned this really early on. You've got to have a scrum that can... You know, based on that alone, we hired Phil Keith Roach, one of the best scrum coaches in the world, full-time. Your full-time job is to make sure... You make sure I pick the right people to scrummage properly. But more upon the coaching side of you, we get ahead of anyone else in our ability to scrum. We then take on a full-time line-out guy in Simon Hardy, full-time line-out coach. These are the real specialist coaches who are working for me, Andy Robinson, who are like the main coaches. But we had real specialists in these basics that we knew we had to get right. And your only job is line-out and scrum. That's your job in life. Now, you start to put that on people who are good coaches, then you'll get results. And they then fix your selection, how you train, everything else. So the basics are absolutely key in terms of any high-performing team. But you've got to understand what they actually are. And everyone in your organization will go, bang, bang, bang. That's the basics of our game.
Right. One we obviously have to talk about is Teacup. And this, what I really like about Teacup, so thinking clearly...
Correctly.
Crikey. So I'm not doing it. Thinking correctly under pressure is the idea that you can train mental toughness. Yeah. Talk about Teacup and also how someone listening could improve their Teacup.
Well, first of all, Teacup came from Yudar Shanir, because the Israeli guy. You mentioned the Royal Marines. I mean, he was a military person. And he was just talking about what they did in the Israeli armed forces. And he said, you know, we're all about pressure. And he said, you know, if you think of the history of Israel, you know, that they've learnt from what their history is, you know, we're not going to ever be pressurized or not handle any situation. So they're tough. But I changed, and he got really stressed with me about this, because I've got this C-tup, and I've just moved the records around. So instead of C-tup, let's call it teacup, a very English word, which I won't forget. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So instead of correctly, and he's no, you can't, and he got really quite annoyed at me. And I went, well, I don't care what you're saying. Yeah,
yeah.
I
can just see laws and rules.
I can just see this teacup.
Yeah.
And teacup is thinking correctly under pressure. And it's very straightforward. And if you think of people listening who have got children, say, you know, I've got three kids, they're all kind of grown up now. And if they're listening to this, they'd all fold their arms and cross their legs. Here he goes off in his teacup stuff. It's an education process, because what we're saying is they're normal kids. They're out there. They will come across pressure situations. If they've not experienced them before, which probably the chances are they won't, but more importantly, they've not thought through what would I do if that was happened to me in that situation, or they've not discussed it with their friends or their parents or their family, the chance of thinking correct under pressure are really small. All these horrendous words kick in, you know, choke, freeze, bottle, rabbits in the headlights. Conversely, if you've thought through in a non-pressurized situation, if this was to happen, what would we do? There's a very high chance, backed up by the most sophisticated data, you'll think correctly and make the right decision in that moment in time. But it's not about experience. It's about actually thinking through in advance. What am I going to do in that situation? So what I did with the rugby team was to actually just role play situation after situation after situation. Mm. And at times I used to like having three things available in a team room, a clock, a scoreboard and a whiteboard. And I'd just bring a player up and say, you should use Matt Dawson, one of your BBC guys, who, you know, brilliant player, but one of the brightest guys I've ever played with. I'd just stand Dawson in front of these three things. Okay, scoreboard, you know, England 12, Australia 16, we're 4 points down. Clock, there's 5 minutes to go. Then on the whiteboard, I'd set up a situation, say, what would you do? Now, if he or she, if I'm talking to the ladies' team, if that player can't answer me immediately, potentially there's somebody who's not at the moment been able to think correct under pressure. Because most pressure things have a time thing attached to them. So if Matt's got to stand there and go, okay, what would we do here? We haven't got time to do that. We're 4 points down. Here's a situation. What would you do? So Matt would say what he'd do, sit down. We'd then have a debate in the team about it. And we wouldn't leave the room until we'd all 100% agree that's what we would do. Then when it happens in the real world on Saturday, or, you know, there's a high chance you'll make the right decisions, and you end up with a library of all this stuff. You just keep. Now, you can change it, but you just keep all this sort of stuff. And I see so many sports teams, mm-hmm. in all sports, when the real pressure, you can see them trying to make it up at that moment in time, that's what you can't do. And I think this teacup stuff is huge, and it's just a, it's how you educate people to think correctly under pressure. And the key word is correctly. Can you make the correct decisions in that moment in time?
So a couple of examples you gave, really nice ones. So at the Olympics, obviously, because you were involved very closely with 2012, a key person in that. But so Emily Seebohm, the Australian swimmer.
Yeah,
who basically knocked out, the fastest time in the heats, and then said, she just assumed she'd won. So she hadn't considered defeat and lost to Missy Franklin. But the one that really, I shouldn't say tickled, but did tickle me somewhat, was the Chinese divers. So just, explain what happened.
Well, that was from the Athens Games. Very famous one. But, these two divers, called Bo and Canaan, they'd never been beaten. They'd never lost. And quite simply what happened was that after you do five dives to win the gold medal in the synchronized pairs. After four dives, they're way ahead. So they've got, they're way ahead. I think it was the Americans and Russians in second and third. So these two have got one dive to win the gold medal. They're the world champs. They've never been beaten. They're the two superstars of world diving. China, the best diving country bar none. So they do this dive, and they literally land on their backs. It was the worst dive you've ever seen. It's a bit like you and me doing it after a few beers on a Saturday night. It was that bad. And all that happened was, when they were about to dive, this guy had got through all the Greek security. This is Athens in the Athens Games. He'd got through all the Greek security, and he got up on the springboard. So if you imagine the high diving board, they had this other guy who's on the springboard. He's got a tutu on and numbers on his chest, which is a betting number. So they can't dive, basically, because this guy's on the board jumping up and down, and eventually jumps in, and it all kicks off. This was a huge security breach. It doesn't even need to tell you or your audience, the history of Olympic Games and security isn't crash hot. So when something like this happens, it's a huge, huge thing. So they can't dive, so they're sent back down the changing room, and they sat down there for a huge amount of time because they'd never experienced this before. So what happened is they lost their routine, they lost their mojo, they'd never been asked to back off a dive. I mean, you think that's ridiculous, because there's so many things could happen when you're on the top diving board, you're about to dive, and I've sort of thought about this through and done sort of, exercises with a lot of people about this. I'm up to about 30 things could happen from pigeons to lasers to a terrorist attack to electricity to all sorts of stuff. Someone's ill. Up to 30 things could actually happen for the judge to say, you can't dive back down the changing room. So it could happen. So what I'm saying is, that is a classic teacup moment. Can you think correctly? So what would you do if it's delayed 10 minutes, 20 minutes, an hour? But what you don't do is sit there and think, what the hell are we going to do now? And they just completely choked. Then they came out and made their dive. That's when they landed on their back, and they came eighth.
Yeah.
So that one moment in time, they didn't understand how to think correctly in the pressure, purely because they're not thought through ever could this happen. So this comes about what we've been speaking about, is ideas coming through from all the team about, oh, we've got this covered, we've got this covered. And you mentioned the Royal Marines. I learned so much from the Royal Marines, because, when you think about the Royal Marine officer, these guys who go to war to look after us, their average age is 21, 22. They've not experienced all this stuff. But what they do, and we learned this, they spend hours and hours and hours in the classroom just going through scenario after scenario after scenario. So they are amazing sportsmen. They're amazing athletes. They can run forever, these guys. They're incredibly fit. They're great with their rifles, all this stuff. But their real skill is how they think correctly in pressurized situations. And what they taught me is, you can't possibly experience this, because we're all young people. And also, you imagine war, you get into the most bizarre predicaments. But the more you can actually think about it, and their big thing is, can they think correctly under pressure? And that again, we learned so much from those. And that, as I said before, about you go on the pitch, it's nil-nil. It doesn't matter what happens on the pitch, you've got to come out having won. These guys in the military, Yudai Shinir, the Royal Marines, they get on that helicopter, they think they know what's going to happen. All they know is they've got to get back on the helicopter and come back in one piece and safe and done whatever their job is. But what they're making clear, it doesn't happen the way it's always supposed to happen. Teacup allows you to think. And once you get away of this thinking, even if something comes up you've not thought about before, there's a chance you'll think.
Thinking in that way.
In that way. You've got that process you've got that process in place. And we did a huge amount of things like that. Hence, back to the World Cup final, I was so pleased the way we handled the referee, what was going on. Because there's pressure everywhere, and we could have completely folded and lost that game.
Yeah.
and being the fourth team to make the final and not win.
Yeah.
Which that's why I come back to it. The more I think about it, that is England's best ever game.
So those Chinese divers as well, they came out and they did to some degree blame it on the man in the tutu. And that, you know, when you've got this teacup, then that feeds into another thing that you talk about, which is having a no moaning culture, no what ifs. You know, and if they'd have been thinking in that way, that they wouldn't have done that. And you did say something very interesting just quickly about this. You mentioned your kids. You talk a lot when they were growing up about teacup with your kids. Yeah, so you can apply this. Anyone listening, this isn't just for sports teams or business. This is anyone.
Totally. Yeah. It's, you know, just think of, you know, on the streets when they're out in pubs, nightclubs, whatever. I'm talking about children now.
Yeah.
You know, how are they going to handle this? What are you going to do? So it's, you know, you just keep to a fault trying to make them understand what can actually happen and using your own experience to make sure that they've got all the bases covered. You know, honestly, now they're all kind of grown up all around the world. I get texts and tweets from all around the world going, Dad, have a look at this. Not a lot of teacup going on here. And it's in sport and business.
It's ingrained in their heads.
It's ingrained. I mean, yeah. You know, without being too serious about this, but it is a serious subject. If you're walking down the street in Oxford Street and someone comes out with a knife, what do you do? Have you thought about it? Or do you just freeze and go, what do I do? Yeah. Now, if you've actually thought through what I would actually do, there's a higher chance, I think, under a real pressure situation, which just becomes some nutter comes out from anywhere. It can happen to anybody, you know that. Yeah. What do you do? How do you handle it? You know, what are you wearing at the time? What clothes can you defend yourself with? All this sort of stuff. And this is what you just learn to do. And that's that one incident can actually save you or not. And it's just really being on top of all this sort of stuff. And it's just teacup. And, you know, as I say, I've got three great kids, but they understand this. And I've just become a grandfather for the first time. So
congratulations.
So Jess will now be teaching her little daughter, Zeffy, teacup, I'm sure. So she'll kind of understand it even more now she's a parent.
Very final thing, and this one won't take long, is moving beyond number one.
Well, what beyond number one? And again, I got this listening to a conference where the company I was at, they're the number one in the world. So the number one in the world. And we got to number one in the world 2 years before the World Cup. We were the number one ranked team in 2001. So I think we could have won the World Cup any time then. So when you get to number one, what do you do? Because suddenly everyone's chasing you. You are there to be shot at. So what number one was, and I learned this from this business, we're now not going to become just the number one rugby team in the world. We're going to become the number one sports team in the world. So we're now going to start to study other sports, other things we do. And if anybody in sport is looking in to say, okay, we want to look at someone, they're going to come look at the England rugby team. What are we doing around, you know, all these things around nutrition, data, analytics, sports psychology, all this sort of stuff? Let's go and study other sports to make sure we're ahead of other sports and what we're actually doing. So you kind of open your doors a bit. So we're going beyond number one. So we're not satisfied of being the best rugby team in the world. Can we be the best sports team in the world? Or can we be the best team sports team in the world? Start to actually then invest in your team, your coaches, some of your players even, to go and see what other people are actually doing to make sure we're beyond number one. And that's, you know, and that's why I, again, learned from the business world. It's a great term, and we use that big time. We were number one in the world. What do we do now? Do we just sit here and be shot at, or do we go to a whole new level so these guys are still chasing us? Yeah. And that's what I was most proud of doing. And I used to leak stuff to the press and to make sure, you know, Eddie Jones in Australia was reading this, because he'd be thinking, oh, my God, what are they doing now?
Yeah.
And sometimes it was exaggerated a bit, but I knew the impact it was having, because I wanted them all to think, we're not standing still. We're not just waiting here now. We're going beyond number one and we're moving forward still.
Which ties back into that continual growth and learning, which is what it's all about on an individual, a business and a sporting level.
Totally.
Right, Clive Woodward, Sir Clive Woodward, it's been an absolute joy having you in. Thank you very much.
I thoroughly
enjoyed How to Win, another absolute belter of a book.
Very kind of you to say so. I really enjoyed talking to you. Thank you.
Thanks very much for listening to this episode of Don't Tell Me The Score. I really hope you enjoyed our conversation. And I would, of course, be delighted to hear your thoughts, ideas and questions. Do get in touch via my website, simonmundy.com. I do really appreciate you listening. And if you could leave a kind rating and review, I would be sincerely grateful. All that remains is for me to say I hope you'll join me again next time. Until then, thank you and goodbye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.